Well, we're continuing our series in Acts. We come to the penultimate chapter. We come to a gripping and authentic narrative as Paul, having appealed to Caesar, journeys to Rome. This sermon has the title Rome at Last, but I've put a slight question mark against that. I'm reminded that when British Airways first initiated their supersonic services to New York, they had a slogan that read, "Breakfast in London, lunch in New York," to which people rapidly added the third tack, "Baggage in Rio." And it's with that kind of travelling anticlimax that we have a title that says Rome at Last, and Paul ends up shipwrecked in Malta. But as we know, Acts is not a triumphalistic record of progress, but it's more a cycle of preaching, of difficulty, of persecution, and new opportunities for witness. And that cycle continues with the passage that we have tonight. Time forbade us to read it all, but if you've got your Bibles open, we're going to look at the whole of chapter 27 and the first 10 verses of chapter 28. It's a long story, but it's important to do justice to all the events in the story. And so what I'm going to try to do is to summarize it first of all. So here's a quick canter through the whole of this narrative. We notice first of all, from the very first verse, that we have that word "we" that crops up several times in Acts. It means that Luke, the author, is present. He was there on the ship with Paul and also with another man called Aristarchus. We then notice that the centurion called Julius, who is in charge of this party, is very favorable towards Paul. He allows him to visit his friends when they get to Sidon. If I can work this thing properly, we're going to have a look at the map of the whole journey. The first call was in Sidon, and Paul was allowed some liberty there. We might even speculate that Julius might have been one of those people who was hauled in to that assembly that we were hearing about last week when Paul testified so powerfully before Agrippa. We don't know, but he shows great kindness to Paul. The first stages of the journey involved coastal voyaging, but already we read in verses 4 and 5 that there were some contrary winds that slowed them down. And then they got to a place called Myra, which you can see on the map at the southern part of Turkey. And it was there that they transshipped to a very much larger ship. The grain ships from Egypt used this as a stopping point, and they transshipped to one of the imperial grain ships that was headed for Rome. And this ship, too, made slow and difficult progress. You can see this in verses 7 to 9, and it was taken off course, to the extent that they knew that they would not be able to make it to Rome before the sailing season ended for the winter. And so they end up on the southern coast of Crete and a decision about where to spend the winter. Paul gives them a doom-laden prediction of disaster. Verse 10, he tells them that he can see that our voyage is going to be disastrous and bring great loss to ship and cargo and to our own lives also. But understandably, perhaps, the centurion and the master of the ship chose to ignore that and to push on. And then, as we read, initially they had a gentle south wind, but then the storm came upon them in full force. And we can see, as that narrative proceeds, various stages of desperation. They hauled in the lifeboat when they could. Once again, you can imagine Luke hanging onto the rope as the boat came in. They undergirded the ship to stop it breaking up. And then they lowered an anchor and just let the ship run before the storm. And then they got to the point where they threw some of the cargo overboard and then some of the ship's tackle as well. And then in verse 20 of chapter 27, we have this statement that when neither sun nor stars appeared for many days and the storm continued raging, we finally gave up all hope of being saved. Who's saying this? This is Luke. Luke, who had accompanied Paul throughout his missionary journeys. Luke, who had seen the Lord perform great miracles in and through Paul. And here he is at the end of hope. All hope is being given up of being saved. It's that desperate. And then the Lord appears to Paul and he gives him a prophecy of safety. Look at verse 23. Last night, an angel of the God whose I am and whom I serve stood beside me and said, "Do not be afraid, Paul. You must stand trial before Caesar, and God has graciously given you the lives of all who sail with you." This contradicts his earlier warning, but this was a vision from the Lord rather than Paul using his own considerable expertise as a Mediterranean traveler. And so it goes on. The sailors realize that they're nearing land. Some of them try to escape, but Paul moves forward immediately and says, unless they stay on the ship, we will be lost. And so the soldiers immediately cut the ropes and prevent the sailors from escaping. And then Paul urges everyone to eat, and they do so, and we read that they are encouraged by that process. And then the ship strikes a sandbar and begins to break up. And at this point, the soldiers plan to kill the prisoners, but the centurion intervenes primarily to preserve Paul's life. And then everyone gets ashore one way or another, either swimming or on bits of the ship. And if we move into chapter 28 briefly, we find that they realize they're on an island called Malta, and they have a very kind reception from the islanders. They're making a fire to warm themselves up, and as Paul is engaged in this process, a snake emerges, appears to bite him, but Paul, much to their surprise, survives, and having thought he was a murderer receiving justice, they now think he must be a god. And then as we move towards the end of our passage tonight, we see Paul visiting the chief official of the island, Publius. We see him healing his father, and then we see people from all over the island bringing people to be healed, probably both by Paul and by Luke, the doctor. And we read, lastly, in verse 10 of chapter 28, that the islanders honored us in many ways, and when they were ready to sail, gave us the supplies that we needed. When I was starting to churn on this chapter a few weeks ago and to think about it, I talked to one of my normal conversation partners, nobody here, and I asked him whether he had any views on Acts 27. And he thought for a moment and said, no, none at all. To be quite honest, I've never been quite sure why it's in the Bible. Well, thanks for that. That was really helpful. But the question becomes even more acute when we realize that there are stories like this in classical literature. Homer in Greek, Virgil in Latin, and various other classical writers used a story of shipwreck and salvation. It was standard material. It was like the standard material we have in our children's stories. You may have heard them as a child. You may be plagued into reading them incessantly at the moment as a parent or a grandparent, but you'll know there's basically a standard format. You find a good, virtuous person. They're in a good situation. They experience a crisis that causes them great concern. There's an external intervention, either by a fairy godmother or a fat controller, or it seems to me in this case, by good dinosaurs, which my grandchildren seem to be fixated on. The crisis is resolved, people cheer up, everyone lives happily ever after. But there was a standard format too in the ancient world. A ship sailed in benign conditions. There was a storm. There was a shipwreck. There was a landfall. And there were friendly natives. It was so common that there was a word for it in Latin poetry. It was called poetica tempestas. You don't need an A-level in Latin to understand what that means. And so there's perhaps a suspicion, is Luke, who's writing this narrative for a guy called Theophilus, thinking, well, perhaps old Theophilus would like a bit of poetica tempestas, so let's stick it in just before we get to the end of my narratives. But this cannot be the case. If we look closely, we can see that there are some very, very important spiritual lessons to be drawn from Luke's account. I just want to draw our attention to four of them. The first one is the authenticity of what we have here. The "we" word affirms the authenticity of Luke's writing in Acts. We need this because there are so many important lessons that we've already learned from this book. But Luke also includes quite a lot of detail. You'll notice the detail that we had on the route that the ship followed. You'll notice in verse 27 that he talks about the 14th night. And this route and the time that it took has been validated by people who know rather a lot about Mediterranean conditions and the kind of ships that were around in those days and what they would do if they were just being driven before a storm. A famous Scottish mariner called James Smith in the mid-19th century did many calculations about this voyage and came to the conclusion that, yes, on the 14th night and thereafter, they would just about be ready to make a landfall on Malta. This is not a standard piece of poetry that's been thrust in. It's a true story. The second thing that we can learn is something about Paul's character, which we find further illustrated here. There is a caricature view of Paul, which I have to say is fairly common among feminist theologians, that he was a grumpy old man, firing off irascible letters to churches, telling them how they ought to behave. But this is completely at variance with the picture that we get here and elsewhere in Acts. We see him respected by the centurion. We see him as an experienced traveler trying to bring his experience to those who are with him. We see him being very bold indeed in taking the lead after he has the vision from the Lord. And from there on, Paul is in control. We can see that he commands respect and obedience from everybody in the ship. We can see that he's concerned for his fellow travelers, encouraging them and recommending them to eat. We can see his decisiveness in keeping the sailors on board to help and not jumping ship. We can see that when there's wood to be collected for a fire, he's there gathering sticks. And we can see that when people think he is a god and he's called upon to do a healing, he prays first so that people know the identity of the true God who will make this healing happen. And so we have a picture of a wise and a caring and a proactive and a deeply spiritual man. And we need that reassurance if we're going to follow Paul's example and listen to what he says in his letters. The third thing that we can learn from here is something more about the gospel. What do we see in this story about the gospel and its progress? The answer to that question is not actually obvious if we look at the passage. Elsewhere in Acts, where people believe, Luke writes it down and records it. I'll give you a few examples. They go to Philippi, and Luke writes down that there's a lady called Lydia who is converted. He writes down that there's a jailer who comes before Paul with his family and asks about salvation. Paul goes to Athens, and despite a lukewarm reception, Luke records that a few people believed. Paul goes to Corinth, the synagogue ruler and many others are recorded as believing. Paul goes to Ephesus, and we read that the name of Jesus is held in high honor, and many believed. But here, we have no similar statement. We don't have a Philippian jailer moment where someone comes and begs for salvation. If you've been to Malta and bought the same guidebook as I did when I went to Malta, you would find an emphatic statement that the whole island was converted to Christianity in 60 AD, led by the chief official Publius. That's what it says in the guidebook, but it doesn't say that in the account that we have here. There appears to be silence, and arguments from silence are never persuasive. But we do see that God is powerfully at work. In John Calvin's commentary, he points to the key turning point of verse 23, that last night an angel of the God to whom I belong and whom I serve stood beside me and said, "Do not be afraid, Paul. You must stand trial before Caesar, and God has graciously given you the lives of all who sail with you." And Calvin says in his commentary that these words implicitly commended the gospel. These words implicitly commended the gospel. And if the gospel is implicit rather than explicit, we must look very carefully at what we see here and also avoid a temptation to overmuch allegory or reading our own expectations into the text. So what do we see? We see that the Lord's word comes when all hope was gone. Paul brings them the words of the Lord with great conviction, and they receive them, at least to the point of achieving their physical salvation. And we also see that the only way of salvation was the Lord's way. They had done all they could, but it was to no avail. And in the most graphic way, the ship's company had seen that their physical salvation depended not on anything that they could do, but on committing themselves to follow the words of the God whom Paul served. And the same applied to their spiritual salvation. We don't know how they responded, but we do know that this is a powerful illustration of the salvation that is available to us as it was to them. Like the sailors, we might try to save ourselves by our own actions, only to find that whatever we do, we fail. And we may reach the point where we have to ask where we are putting our hope and realize that all other hope has in fact gone. And we too can find that God has graciously given us life through Jesus, and that we too can belong and serve the God to whom Paul belonged and served. On Malta, we see, as we said, miraculous healing and a grateful response from the islanders. Paul had a 3-month evangelistic opportunity as they wintered on Malta. And when on departure, the islanders honored us in many ways. We can only assume that the Holy Spirit had been at work in their hearts. Is the guidebook right that everyone came to Christ? We don't know. It's difficult to believe that nobody did, because the power of the gospel had clearly been at work. The last thing I want us to look at, and perhaps to spend a little bit more time looking at, is the question of God's providence. What do we mean by providence? Well, there are many definitions, but in general we mean that God is active in sustaining the world he has created, and he directs all things and all people in accordance with his plans and his designs. Paul's plan was to get to Rome. in Romans 15, verse 24, he writes to the Romans, "I have been longing for many years to see you. I plan to do so when I go to Spain. I hope to visit you while passing through and to have you assist me on my journey there after I have enjoyed your company for a while." God had promised him that this would happen. You remember that verse a few chapters back, "As you have testified about me in Jerusalem, so you must also testify in Rome." But the way that this worked out was not exactly as Paul had envisaged it. He was going not as a missionary en route to Spain, but as a prisoner. There's an old hymn that you may recall that starts, "God moves in a mysterious way his wonders to perform. He plants his footsteps in the sea and rides upon the storm." I did think about requesting it, but we had enough sea billows in the program already. But one of the verses reads like this, "Judge not the Lord by feeble sense, but trust him for his grace. Behind a frowning providence, he hides a smiling face." And if we're honest, quite often, God's providence towards us seems to be frowning rather than smiling. And this was the case with Paul. Look at the passing of time and the frustration that must have been involved. You'll remember from previous sermons that after his arrest in Jerusalem, Paul was transferred to Caesarea for trial by Felix. And following his trial, he was imprisoned for 2 years. We read in Acts 24, "As Paul discoursed to Felix on righteousness, self-control, and the judgment to come, Felix was afraid and said, 'That's enough for now. You may leave. When I find it convenient, I will send for you.' At the same time, he was hoping that Paul would offer him a bribe. So he sent for him frequently and talked with him. When 2 years had passed, Felix was succeeded by Porcius Festus, but because Felix wanted to grant a favor to the Jews, he left Paul in prison." Paul faced 2 years imprisonment at a time when he was at the height of his powers and his energy and in the full flood of his ministry. 2 years with frequent, useless conversations with someone who had rejected the gospel and wanted to talk to Paul, either because he was bored or short of cash, or both. Intense frustration. There must have been some spiritual consolidation and reflection during this time, but it was not exactly the high point of Paul's life. I want just to throw up what's called in the trade a busy slide, but it's the only way that I could think of illustrating this point. What we've got here is a kind of timeline of Paul's ministry, and the bright yellow patch represents the 2.5 years of imprisonment and shipwreck. If you can work out the various squares that I've somewhat inelegantly put on it, what it is saying to us is that at the time of Paul's imprisonment, he had already completed his first 3 missionary journeys. He'd already written the books that we know as Galatians. He'd already written the books that we know as 1 and 2 Corinthians. He had already written 2 books to the Thessalonians. He had already written the letter to the Romans. He was at the height of his powers, both in terms of an evangelist and in terms of a teacher. And yet, he's taken out of it, taken completely off the pitch for 2.5 years. Just imagine what that must have been like. Let's take the example of somebody else at the height of their powers now. I'm sure you recognize the man who must be the sportsman of this year, Rory McIlroy, with 2 majors under his belt in the last couple of months. Just imagine that Rory McIlroy's dad, who appears to be his manager, calls a press conference and says, "Rory's giving up golf for the next 2 or 3 years. He's not going to compete in any majors. He's just going to take some time out and find some space. It's just unimaginable that someone functioning in that way would be taken out of the action. But this is what it was like for Paul. Why? Well, as with Job and his trials, we don't know the answer. And sometimes that is the case with us. We may find that we are stuck in places where we want to be, in jobs that we don't want to do, with people we don't want to mix with. We may find that we're in situations that make no sense to us, and we want the Lord to take us out of them because we feel we can serve him far better if he does. And we often cry with the psalmist, "How long, O Lord?" And the time can be much longer than we would wish. This was the case with Paul. This is the case with us. And we need to learn that sometimes what seems to be a frowning providence is God's ways and thoughts being much higher than our ways and thoughts, and we are in realms that we cannot penetrate with our finite human minds. More positively, there is a smiling face. God granted Paul his protection throughout this period. Although Paul's position was far from ideal, we can see evidence of the Lord's hand on him, protecting him from danger. Did you notice there were three specific death threats in that narrative? The storm, the threat to kill the prisoners, and the snake. And although the Lord had apparently put Paul's activities on hold, he continued to protect him, and each of these rescues from death was a confirmation of God's plan for him. And we may at times feel frustrated by our own situations, but we can be reassured that God is still protecting us, and God is still working out his plans for us. And God also gave to Paul a degree of confidence. Paul's initial recommendation to abandon the voyage in the south of Crete was rejected, but then the word from the angel gave him the power to take control of events. He communicates the message, he encourages them all, he makes a prophecy about a landfall on an island, he warns about the escape of the sailors and is instantly obeyed, and he tells everyone to eat, and we read they were all encouraged. And then on Malta, when further ministry opportunities present themselves, he moves easily back into apostolic mode with prayer and with healing. And Paul had therefore established his God-given authority over a centurion, over soldiers, over a motley ship's crew, a group of prisoners, a governor, and the inhabitants of Malta. And despite 2 years' absence from active ministry, God moves back in and shows him that he can still use him powerfully. Whichever way we look at it, this 2.5 year period was not the most fruitful in Paul's ministry. But he got to Rome, and he gets there next week. And when he got there, these experiences would have strengthened him for what awaited him and for what he had to do. At Rome, the center of the empire, he would meet a far greater diversity of people than he had yet met. And he would also face the prospect of further imprisonment. And throughout this period that we've been looking at, God has been further preparing him for those things. So, is it Rome at last? It will be soon. And when Paul arrived in Rome, he did so in the full knowledge of the providence and the sustaining power of the one who had delivered him from past danger and had confirmed his authority to lead and to heal and to testify. And if we look at that example of Paul and we look back over this whole narrative, we can see that we too can know God's salvation, we can know his providence and his plans for us, and we can trust in his empowering for future work and for witness.